that's Korach, details for us the rebellion of Korach from the tribe of Levi against Moshe Rabbeinu. It's interesting to note, as the Torah Semes points out, that in general, throughout the experiences of the Jewish people in the desert, it never was the tribe of Levi that was ever involved in any of the disputes. Whether it was by the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, where the tribe of Levi remained loyal to Moshe Rabbeinu, or by the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, where the tribe of Levi did not participate, it is here, explains the Torah Semes, that so unusual that the tribe of Levi itself, and a very important individual from the tribe of Levi, Korach, who our rabbis tell us was one of the Nosei Aron, who carried the Aron, was involved in this rebellion. What exactly was the rebellion against Moshe? So here our rabbis give many different explanations as to the cause of the rebellion, as to what incited the rebellion. Rashi brings down that there was a certain amount of jealousy that Korach had that his younger cousin Elitzaphan became the Nasi, the prince of the tribe of Levi. There's also a certain amount of jealousy that not only did Moshe take being the king over the Jewish people, but a certain amount of nepotism that he gave the next greatest honor of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, to his brother Aaron. He was upset that Aaron was the priest. According to others, he himself wanted to be the priest. The 250 men that came with him in this rebellion were from the tribes of Reuven, and they felt perhaps that since Reuven was the eldest son, that they were slighted, that Levi, the third son, was in the position of serving God. Perhaps they should be in the position of serving God, and that they wanted to be the high priest. Be that as it may, they come against Moshe Rabbeinu, and they challenge his authority. And that's why, as the Malbim, as well as others explain, the real deep part of the rebellion, the underlying message of the rebellion, was that the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu was not a complete authority. That we cannot trust that which Moshe Rabbeinu did as the complete authority, that everything he says is correct. Even if it's a small detail as to the appointments of Moshe Rabbeinu or any aspect of that which Moshe Rabbeinu said, there was something wrong in the authority of Moshe. And that's why, explains the Malbim, the whole rebellion had to be quelled, but immediately. The ground opened itself up and Korach and his followers were swallowed alive, and those that challenged and wanted to be the high priest, the 250 people who were challenged to bring a ketoret, an incense offering, were burned alive. The punishment was quick and swift to just underscore and emphasize that Moshe and Moshe's authority is absolute. Because once you start challenging the authority of Moshe, you can then come to challenge the entire authority of Moshe, Moshe in the form of a lawgiver, and then come to challenge the Torah itself. The rest of the parasha comes to try and show us beyond the shadow of a doubt that indeed Aaron is the one chosen by God to be in the position of the high priest, where all the different tribes bring their stick to the Ohel Moed, to the tent of meeting, and it's only Aaron's staff that blossoms into beautiful buds to show that he is the one chosen by God. And the parasha ends with the 24 gifts of Kahuna, the gifts that were given to the priest that were special, the first of the grain of the land, the challah, the first offering, the first part of the bread. These were given as the gifts to the priest. What I'd like to try to examine together today is based on the text in the Torah. What was the argument of Korach? What was Korach really trying to argue? And clearly, if the Torah is telling us about the argument of Korach, it must have moral implications for us today. These arguments must be issues and ideals that we grapple with as well. And to understand what was it that went wrong in what Korach was arguing, to teach us a lesson in our direction within our relationship to God as well. If we take a look in source number 1, the parsha begins that Korach, the son of Yitzhar, began a rebellion along with Datan and Aviram, own son of Pelet, 250 outstanding men. And in verse 3, they demonstrated against Moshe and Aaron and declared to them, "You have gone too far. All the people in the community are holy, and God is with them. Kikol ha'ida kulam kedoshim uvetocham Hashem. Why are you setting yourselves above God's congregation? Umadua titnasu al kahal Hashem." So the Torah tells us that the argument of Korach was an argument of the entire nation is holy, and if the entire nation is holy and God is found within the entire nation, then umadua titnasu al kahal Hashem, how could you raise yourself up above the rest of the congregation? This holier-than-thou attitude. The first thing we need to understand is what exactly is the argument of Korach, that everyone is holy. Kikol ha'ida kulam kedoshim, that everyone has God within them. The second aspect I'd like to try to understand together is a very beautiful statement of the Ari HaKadosh, who says in source 3, it's brought down in the Sivah Shalom, Shenishmat Kayin nitlapsha b'Korach, v'nishmat Hevel nitlapsha b'Moshe. The soul of Kayin is found in Korach. An aspect of Kayin, we know Kayin and Hevel were the first two brothers in this world, and the jealousy between Kayin and Hevel, and Kayin ultimately killing Hevel. There's an aspect of Kayin that's found in Korach, and an aspect of Hevel that's found in Moshe. So the second thing we need to understand together is, what does this mean, the connection between Kayin and Korach? I'd like to take a look at three approaches. The first, based on the writings of Lubavitch Rebbe. The second, the Slonim Rebbe, the Nesiv HaShalom. And the third, a more Litvak approach, the Das Torah, Rabbeinu Yerucham HaLevi, the Mashgiach of Mir. Approach number one, based on the writings of Lubavitch Rebbe, is found in the book, The Inside Story, which is an adaptation of the Sichas of the Rebbe, edited by Rabbi Tauber. Source 4. Korach had a problem with holiness. Why is praying a holy act while plowing a field is not? Why is studying God's Torah a holy pursuit while developing the material resources of God's world is not? If holiness means proximity to the divine, then everyone and everything is holy, for God dwells in each individual and in every component of his creation. Is Moses atop Mount Sinai, or Aaron offering korbanot in the sanctuary, any closer to God than the craftsman at his workbench and the laborer at his daily toil? Whence this dividing line between the spiritual and the material? The apportionment of roles did not itself disturb Korach, who appreciated the need for spirituality and transcendence in man's relationship with his Creator. He was himself a Levite, a spiritual notch above the materially involved Israelite. But Korach, while seeing his own calling as spiritual, was outraged by the elevation of the spirit as the higher and holier role, quote-unquote. Korach saw the material and the spiritual as separate but equal venues of achievement. Both are part of God's creation, he argued. Both, when properly employed, can equally bring man close to God. Korach's argument on this level is, yes, there's a need for a hierarchical system, but however, kikol ha'ida kulam kedoshim, everyone is holy. If everyone is holy, so although you need a regular person and you need a priest, but that doesn't mean that the priest is any holier than the regular person. The day laborer is just as holy as the person who's serving God or the person involved in Torah study. Kikol ha'ida kulam kedoshim, everybody is equally as holy. And this would imply as well to the Matno Kehuna, the gifts that were given to the priest as well. The Rebbe explains that on a deeper level, the Matno Kehuna represent the resources that each and every individual reserves for the quote-unquote Kohen within himself. The time, the energy, the possession he allots for his own spiritual pursuits. Here again, Korach did not object to the Matno Kehuna per se, but he refused to accept the notion that the bushel of grain that the Israelite farmer reserves for the Kohen, or the daily hour or two he devotes for study and prayer, are somehow loftier and holier than the rest of his harvest or day. Korach agreed that the materially involved individual ought to designate a certain portion of his life and wealth for matters of the spirit, supporting the men of the spirit of his community, and setting aside islands of time in his material day for spiritual endeavors of his own. But to see these as the most important aspect of his life, as the ultimate objective of everything he does? And that's their argument. Their argument is, why do you raise yourself and the spiritual ideal that you, and indeed I myself, represent above the congregation of God? This was the argument of Korach. Isn't everybody holy? Yes, we need to give a certain amount of our crops, a certain amount of our time for holy activities, but is that amount of time, or are those crops any holier than any other part of my day or any other crops that I may consume? It seems like a wonderful argument, because indeed we know that God fills the entire world and every individual has the component of God and we are all naturally holy. Where is Korach right and where did Korach make a mistake? So here we need to move into a little bit of philosophy to understand the role of the physical and the role of the material and spiritual in the world we live in. We know that there's a cardinal law of existence in Source 11, that there is none else beside him. So if we would take, for an example, an area 100 cubit feet in size, and a 100 cubit foot object is occupying it, no other object can share this space. If you have an object of infinite size, no other object can possibly occupy any space anywhere. And if we should substitute reality for space, it follows that the reality of God, which suffers no limits or qualification, fills the entire expanse of reality. This is true not only of the physical parameters of time and space, but also the conceptual parameters of existence. The reality of God, which overflows the conceptual boundaries of existence, certainly fills the area framed by these boundaries to the exclusion of all else. And hence we have the axiom, there is none else aside for him. Because any other existence or reality we may identify, the objects and forces of the physical universe, the axiomatic truths we contemplate, the quote-unquote I of our identities, simply have no existential place in which to be. We must therefore conclude that either they do not in truth exist, because if God is in fact everywhere, and God fills the entire world, so where does the I fit into this realm of godliness? So either A, we do not exist, or B, we are not in existences aside from him, besides him, but rather expressions of its all-embracing reality. So if God is everywhere, then either I and the physical world do not exist, or yes, I exist, but we exist as part of his all-embracing reality. And this clearly defines the difference between the physical and the spiritual in this world. Spiritual reality possesses definition and existence, but they are far more ethereal than the brute tangibility of the physical. More importantly, the spiritual entity is of a selfless nature, always expressing and serving a reality greater than itself, while physical matter manifests the I am of its actual being. An idea or an emotion is always about something else. A stone or tree is ostensibly about itself. A person praying or studying is demonstrably relating to a higher truth. A person dealing or eating is demonstrably affirming his individual being. We take up space, but when we deal with a physical matter, so then the space is clearly defined. We're eating, we're involved in physical pursuits, we take up physical space. When a person is involved in spiritual pursuits, in emotions, in thinking, in contemplation, so then they are taking up far less room and thereby attaching themselves to God, whose existence fills the entire world. And that's why of all the worlds and realities created by the Almighty, The physical one is the lowest in degree. Why? Because in a sense, it most conceals his manifest reality. It's a world of doubled and redoubled darkness, so much so that it even contains evil elements which oppose the reality of God, declaring, I am the ultimate. And this is what life is all about. Life is about the elevation of the I, the elevation of that which takes a physical room and bringing it to a level of closeness to God as to be an expression of his all-embracing reality. Continuing in 15, man achieves this goal of housing God in this world by living a material life, by doing so in the service of a higher spiritual goal. When a person spends 90% of his life earning a living, eating, sleeping, recreating, and otherwise attending to his material needs, yet does so in a way that demonstrates that all this is only to enable the 10% he devotes to prayer, study, and charity, and other godly endeavors, he is transforming the very nature of the physical. The I exist of the physical, which so blatantly belies the divine truth, has now become partner to the reality that there's none else besides him. It has acknowledged its subservience to that which is greater than itself. In other words, as long as the material is not made to express its subservience to the spiritual, it remains the element of creation that is furthest from its divine source. Yet when the inferiority of the material is made manifest, when the materially involved individual orders his priorities, so that if every material act is for the sake of the Kohen, and the Kohen within himself, then the lowliest realm of creation becomes its godliest, its greatest assertion of the divine truth. And this is where Korach's mistake lay. The different levels of spirituality among the various segments of the people and within each individual's life do take the form of a hierarchy, a ladder in which a materially involved individual looks up to his more spiritual brother and regards his own spiritual moments as the loftiest part of his day. The farmer regards the produce that he gives to the Kohen as the holiest part of his yield, for represents the spiritual focus of all his endeavors. The businessman looks to the scholar as the ideal. He feels trapped and stifled by the demands of his vocation, and lives for those few precious moments which he manages to devote to study. What life is about is to take the physical and raise it up to the spiritual. Yes, Korach was 100% correct, ki kol haida kulam kadoshim, the entire congregation is holy. But it's holiness in potential. The day laborer, the craftsmen are all holy, but the physical world we live in is a world of potential, and the potential needs to be actualized, it needs to be elevated, it needs to be transformed into a higher spiritual reality. So yes, the crops are a potential for holiness. But they become holy only when you take part of those crops and you give it to the priest. When you take part of your day and you give it to spiritual endeavors, you then transform all the other aspects of the physical into the spiritual. And the Rebbe says so beautifully, the concept of taking the first and the best and giving it to the priest is a model for us as well within our spiritual lives. Take the choicest part of the day, our best hours, right? Some people are evening people, some people are night, some people are day people. Take the best part of your day and dedicate it to community work, dedicate it to study, dedicate it to God. Take the best part of your years of your life. The best has to be given to God. When you take the choicest part of your day and you give it to God, the best hours, the best resources, the best talents, and you invest them for godly purposes, so then all the other talents, which are holy, then take on that role of reaching its fullest potential of holiness. And that's where Cain made a mistake as well. While Cain just brought any of his produce, Hevel brought the best. Cain's argument is the argument of Korah. Bring anything. Everything is holy to God. It will be sufficient. What Hevel and God accepting Hevel's korban sacrifice is teaching us is no. What's really important is the best. Offer the best up to God. Offer the best part of self over to God. In synopsis, element number one, argument number one of Korach, ki kol hayda kulam kadoshim, the entire congregation is holy. Absolutely, you're correct, 100%. However, you're incorrect as well. Because although the entire congregation is holy, and Korach was arguing the high priest is just as holy as the day laborer, in that he is mistaken. The high priest gets special honor, the Rebbe, the teacher, the people involved in spiritual pursuits should be honored. Why? Because they're really living the ideal of taking the physical and being able to elevate it to the spiritual. An individual is able to take the physical aspects of life, the material aspects of life, the elements of self, and able to raise them up to the spiritual, so then indeed they have made the physical aspect holy. Korach was right in the absolute form, but he needed to transform that into the spiritual. Approach number one. Approach number two is based on the Rebbe of Slonim, the Nesiv Shalom, who argues that Korach was really arguing against the whole way God created the world. It's a beautiful medrash in Dvarim Rabbah in Parshas Veschanan. The medrash says, brought in Source 21, Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, Kadosh Baruch Hu said to the Jewish people, Banai, Kol Ma Shebarati Barati Zugot. Everything that was created in this world was created Zugot as partners. Shemayim Ba'aretz Zugot, the heaven and earth are partners. Chama'u Levana Zugot, the sun and moon are partners. Adam V'Chava Zugot, man and woman are partners. Olam Hazev Olam Haba Zugot, this world and the next world are partners. Everything in life has a partner. Aval kvodi echad umiyuchad va'olam. But God's glory is singular and unique in this world. And that's the verse of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, that God is singular, He is unique. While in the rest of creation, everything is zugos, is pairs. Explains in the Siva Shalom, what does this medrash mean? That the world was created by zugos, by pairs. So explains, V'hayyan bazeh ki kol seder habriyam yusan al mashpia umekabel. The whole basis of the world is created on the concept of a mashpia, one who influences, and a mekabel, one who receives. Like the sun gives off light, which the moon reflects. The heavens give off rain, which is accepted by the earth. Likewise, by man and woman. It's this relationship of giving and receiving. Likewise, there's a tzaddik, there's righteous people, through whom there's a hashba, there's a tremendous amount of giving that's brought down, and influence that's brought down in this world. And this is the part that Korach was arguing about. 22. Shechalak al kol inyan zeh haseder shomashpia umekabel. He was arguing against the system of one who gives off influence and one who receives. This is what he means when the entire nation is holy. Why are you raising yourself above the congregation of God? Agrees Korach that yes, we needed a Moshe Rabbeinu. We needed a Mashpia. We needed a teacher in order to give us the Torah. Granted. But now that the Torah is given, there's no longer a necessity to have a mashpia, to have one who's giving off influence. Because once we have the Torah, so we're all on the same level. We don't therefore need anyone who's going to direct us and to teach us. We all heard from God. So okay, we needed Moshe as an intermediary. But once that happened, we're all on the same level. Ki kol hayda kulam kadoshim, Korach is arguing we do not need any hierarchical system. We're all equal. And according to this line of reasoning, continues in the Siv Shalom, he argued against even having anyone as a high priest. Forget about Aaron shouldn't be a high priest. Nobody should be a high priest. Why? Because what was the job of the priest? Also to bring down this hashpa, to bring down this influence upon the people. Because Kohanim, the blessing of the priest, gaining forgiveness for the people. We don't need this, argued Korach. We all have the ability and capability of doing this by ourselves. There should be no high priest. There should be no teachers. And this, in fact, was the difference between Cain and Hevel. Explains in Siva Shalom, source 24, that Hevel was the mashpia, Hevel was the one who gave the influence, and Cain was the one who received it. And that's how he explains so beautifully the pasuk, a very famous verse, when Cain says, Hashomer achi anochi, which we translate, am I my brother's keeper? So we know by the word shomer can also be understood to wait in anticipation. We have this v'avim shamarit hadavar, that Yaakov Avinu, after hearing Yosef Atzadik's dream, he waited and to see when would this dream actually be actualized. So explains the Siva Shalom, Hashomer achi anochi means Cain always waited when would be the day that the tables would be switched, that instead of he being the receiver, he could be the giver. Cain did not like to be the receiver. Korach did not like to be the receiver. Well, there is no need for a giver. And in fact, says the Siva Shalom, that was the real argument between Yosef HaTzadik and his brothers, where Yosef HaTzadik always stood in the middle while the other sheaves bowed down to him. Yosef was the mashpia, he was the mashpir, the giver, while the brothers were the receivers, and they did not like this role and this position. And with this in mind, you can perhaps understand why it was that the ground swallowed up Korach. Because symbolically, the ground opening up is a form of being a makabel, a receiver. It is as if teaching Korach a lesson is that you have to have a giver and you have to have a receiver. Just to end this particular idea with a wonderful imagery that the Nesiva Shalom brings, based on the Be'er Mayim Chaim, also a Hasidic approach, it's a wonderful mashal. He says if we were to take a Mayan Be'er Mayim Chaim, an ever-flowing well, a spring of fresh water, and then you dig a hole, and you say you'd like your hole to be filled up with this water. So what do? You attach a pipe or some type of apparatus between the spring and your hole. So the water flows through the pipe and then the hole is filled up with water. Great. So now I have what I desired. I wanted that this fresh spring of water should be in my new hole, my new pit. So it's there. So you say to yourself, okay, I have no longer a need for the pipe. So you take the pipe away. What will happen after a short amount of time to the water? We all know it's going to be spoiled. It can't retain its freshness sitting in this pit. If you were to keep the pipe there so it would constantly pump in fresh water and you would always have fresh water in your pit, in your hole. This is such a wonderful mashal for the relationship of any Jew to Torah. Torah is the Be'er Mayim Chaim, it's this overflowing stream of water. We are this pit. If we say, oh, I've learned Torah for X amount of years, I know enough, I don't need to be connected to any individual to teach me Torah, I have everything I need within me, so we know that we cannot grow as people. We constantly need to have a flow coming down directly from the source. A mashpia, a Rebbe, a person to teach us, a person to influence us, a person to always generate this newness and this vitality in our relationship with God. I know when I have my high school alumni who are starting to date, so they call me up, talk to me about a young man that they're going out with, one of the first questions that I ask these young women is, does this young man have a Rebbe? Does he have somebody who he can turn to for advice, for guidance, for direction? If you're not attached to a pipe, so you're never going to be able to really grow in life. The second level in synopsis, Korach's argument is we're all holy. If we're all holy, so then we're all attached to the source. If we're all attached to the source, we don't need any individual. Whether it's a Moshe Rabbeinu as a teacher, whether it's a Kohen Gadol as a high priest, we don't need any individual to be the point of attachment that's going to bring down the hashpah, that's going to bring down the influence, that's going to really channel and challenge a person. And that's where Korach was warned. Because the whole system of the world is a system of zugos, it's a system of pairs. You need to have a mashmia and you need to have a makabel. You need to have a giver and a receiver. The sun and the moon, the heaven and the earth, man and woman. It's this whole relationship in life of giving and receiving. The third and final approach is based on Rabbi Yerucham in Das Torah. Explains Rabbi Yerucham, if we are to look at the story of Korach as an individual who suddenly goes berserk overnight, who suddenly becomes power-hungry and jealous and just desires tremendous positions of honor, so then we've misunderstood the story of individual. Pikeach Haya. He was a brilliant individual who had a deep amount of religious sensitivity. To understand what Korach is all about, explains Rabbeinu Yerucham, one needs to look at that famous Mishnah in Ethics of Our Fathers and Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah tells us that any machloket, any argument that's l'shem shamayim, sofali kayem, that for the sake of heaven will endure. And any machloket, any argument that's not for the sake of heaven will not endure. What is the model of an argument for the sake of heaven? So the Mishnah tells us that a model of an argument for the sake of heaven is the argument of Hillel and Shammai, or the schools of Hillel and Shammai. Right? The famous argument, to give an example that we know, is do we light the Hanukkah candles on the first night one and the last night eight, or the first night eight and the last night one? Do we go in ascending or descending order? These arguments are arguments l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, and sofar l'itkayim, they are going to, in the end, endure. What is the example of a machloket that's not l'shem shamayim? It's the argument of Korach and its followers. Explains the Das Torah, the problem with Korach was the problem of l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. He quotes a wonderful medrash, which is very powerful, that the difference between Gehenim and Gan Eden is kichut hasara, is a hair's breadth. Sometimes it's a fine line that makes a distinction between what is correct and proper and what is incorrect and improper. Korach was arguing the entire congregation is holy, which means that we all can become high priests. That we all, if we would want to ascend the spiritual ladder, and we would all want to have this closeness with God, and we would all want to have this connection that we would be the one serving God, so let it be so. We are all holy, and if we should so desire this connection, there should be nothing stopping us. Korach was bothered that there's only one individual in the position of the high priest. So according to the first approach, there should be a hierarchical system, but equal. According to the second approach, there should be no hierarchical system. According to the third approach, there can be a hierarchical system, but it can't be a limited hierarchical system. If we're all holy, so that means if 250 people all want to bring a Keturah, all want to have this close relationship with God, so let it be so. How can you stop people from having this close relationship with God? Sounds good. Sounds like he's correct. So what was Korach's problem? So here says the Das Torah, this is the Chut HaSara, the fine hairbreadth. Because if Korach was only motivated, and his whole intention was to come closer to God, and to have this spiritual high and connection to God, that would have been great. But part of Korach was a certain amount of jealousy as well. He was jealous that Aaron had this closeness to God. If it was just focused on how he could get close to God, that would have been fun. But there was a certain amount of jealousy of how come Aaron is in a position that I want to be in. He doesn't deserve to be where he is. This is the same problem between Cain and Hevel. When Cain's sacrifice is not accepted, was Cain upset because he felt that he wanted to come closer to God, and that he lost the opportunity of coming closer to God? If this is so, God then says to him, Lama charalcha, why are you upset? Hello, v'lama naflu panecha, hello, you titi, saying, you shouldn't be feel bad if this foreigner explains on what happened in the past. Avara oi lishtadel lasik tikun lati, but work for the future. But we know that what was really bothering Cain, it wasn't only that God refused his korban, as much as that he accepted Hevel's korban.
And that's the jealousy, and that's what bothered him. The same problem of Cain is the same problem of Korach. The desire not only to come close to God, but that feeling of how come that person is closer to God than me, that element of jealousy. And this, Rabbeinu Yerucham in Das Chochma Musar and Chelek Aleph explains, is the reason why people do not feel a dveikus, a closeness to God when doing mitzvahs. Inherent in every mitzvah is the concept of dveikus, of closeness to God. How come we don't feel it? So explain to Rabbeinu Yerucham, because when we do many mitzvahs, we have a l'shem atzmo for our own sake involved. Are we really doing it for God? Are we doing it for personal glory? Am I inviting guests into my home because this is what God commanded me, and I want to do the mitzvah of Achnasat Orachim? Or do I want to look good in the eyes of another person? I want to show off my house, my food, my wealth, my talents to this other person. Do I give charity in order to help another individual? Or is my motivation for charity the name that's going to be put on the front door, or the honor that I'm going to receive? The problem in mitzvah observance is the problem of Korach. Are we doing it in order to maintain this close spiritual connection with God? Or are we doing it for a personal reason ourselves, that we have something caught up in this whole equation? There's a beautiful motto of an individual doing it for the sake of heaven that concretizes this idea that's forward in the writings of Rav Dessler, who speaks about in Source 35. The Torah writes of Chanoch, who is the seventh generation after Adam, and Chanoch walked with God, upon which the rabbis say Chanoch was a cobbler, and with every single stitch that he made, he achieved mystical unions with his Creator. So explains Rav Dessler, as well as Rabbeinu Yerucham, of a wonderful idea that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter gave on this. He said that this medrash cannot possibly mean that while he was sitting and stitching shoes for his customer, his mind was engaged on mystical pursuits. This would be forbidden by the law. How could he divert his attention to other matters while engaged on work which he had been hired to do by others? No, says Rabbi Yisrael, the mystical unions which Chanoch achieved was nothing more nor less than the concentration which he lavished on each and every stitch to ensure that it would be good and strong, and that the pair of shoes he was making would be a good pair, giving the maximum pleasure and benefit to whoever would wear them. In this way, Chanoch achieved union with the attribute of his Creator, who lavishes his goodness and beneficence on others. This was his mystical union, quote-unquote. He was united and wholehearted in his desire, a single-minded ambition to attach himself to his Creator's attributes. There could be no question of his ever deceiving or ever overcharging his customers, even unwittingly. This is the model of Chanoch, to be involved in doing things for the sake of God, to emulate God, not to see, well, what can I get out of it? How can I benefit from mitzvah observances? Where is it comfortable for me, and that's when I'll do it? The focus is not on l'shem atzmo for your own sake, but rather l'shem shamayim for the sake of God. We cannot but point out that indeed we do gain benefit from doing mitzvahs, and we do feel good when doing mitzvahs. But again, our focus needs to be not on ourselves, but more altruistic for God. There's a wonderful story that demonstrates this latter idea that's brought down in Small Miracles, of an individual who had a friend who died in an airplane crash. So he was always weary of flying. He had a lot of business. He lived in Montreal. He had a lot of business in New York. So what he used to do is used to drive that distance between Montreal and New York. And he always had a set routine where he would sleep during the afternoon, take a long nap, and then drive basically all night. And he did this for years. It happened one particular time that he began driving, and after around an hour and a half, felt overcome by sleep. Very, very tired. Took a cup of coffee, opened the window, get some air. Never happened to him before. He's done this for years. Took his afternoon nap, and was able to drive all night. So he knew he couldn't go on. He pulled over at a gas station and asked the gas station attendant, are there any motels in the area? So the gas station attendant said, sure. The tourist season is in for another 2 weeks. There should be plenty of rooms. Called up all the motels in that area, all solidly booked. He calls in all the surrounding areas, all booked. The guy said, I got to find a place to stay. Maybe there's a school to sleep in. No school. He said, sounds like a strange request, but maybe there's an old age home. And they might have an extra bed. I'll rent the bed for the night. I'll rent the room for the night. So the gas station attendant said, you know, there happens to be an old age home down the block, a really nice man. Let me give him a call. Sure enough, there was an empty bed. The guy, sleeps there, wakes up refreshed the next morning, and goes to his car. Right before he gets into his car, he says to himself, you know, he turns back to the owner of the old age home and says, you know, I was just thinking before I'm going to leave that I happen, aside from my profession, I happen to be a rabbi. Perhaps there's an old Jewish resident that lives in this home that can come visit them. While I'm here already, let me go visit them. So the owner of the old age home says, you know, it's interesting. We had one Jewish man who happened to have died last night around the time that you came here. He was over 100 years old, and he died without any near of kin and without a penny to his name. So the man, the rabbi, asked him, well, where are you planning on burying him? Well, the owner of the old age home said, the nearest cemetery is in Albany, which is a couple of miles away, and it's a little bit inconvenient. So we're going to bury him in the local, you know, Christian Catholic cemetery, and we will, they have plots for people who die, you know, without any next of kin and without any money. So the man said the following. He said, look, he said, I usually bring my hatchback on my trips. This time I happen to have my station wagon. Would you mind releasing the body to me and let me bury him in a proper Jewish burial? Because after all, he's a Jew, and I'm sure he would like to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. The man said, sure. So he released him, put the coffin to the back of his car, and drove down to New York. And he went to different boroughs, Queens, Brooklyn, and they asked the different burial societies, do you have a place for individuals who don't have a next of kin, who haven't bought a grave plot, where they can be buried? So everyone said, you know, that would be a really good idea. We just don't have it. We'd have to raise some money among the community to buy this guy a plot, and that would take a couple of days. And by then, this poor guy needs to be buried. It's just not going to work. So finally, one of the burial societies said, you know, in Washington Heights, they do have such a society. Around 50 years ago, someone donated money so that there would be a couple of plots that would be around for people in such a situation who die without next of kin, without any money. So he drives him to Washington Heights, and an elderly man is in charge, and he tells him the story. He says, sure, we do have plots available. He said, let me just take down the man's name. He takes the man's name down. He says, can I look at this individual? So he goes over to the coffin and sees this man, and he says, we have a place of honor for this individual. Because the man that you have in the back of your car is none other than the man who started this burial society 50 years ago. So you see that nothing goes unpaid by God. This individual had no idea 50 years earlier that he would need to benefit from this kindness. But God has his ways of working it out to make sure that there would be a shaliach, a messenger of God, to give him his proper burial. But when we set up those burial societies, when we set up the different organizations that we set up, when we're involved in the chesed that we're involved in, is our focus, what can we get out of it? Is it l'shem atzmo, for ourselves, or is it l'shem shamayim, is it for the sake of God? Korach's argument, ki kol ayda kulam kedoshim, that we're all holy. Umadu atin asu al kal shem, why do you raise yourself up above the congregation of God, is an excellent argument. If we all want to strive for holiness, why can't we strive for holiness? And the answer is, go gesund to hate, strive for holiness. And you should become as close to God as possible. But where are you wrong, Korach? You're wrong in the sense that you're doing it for personal motives. If you're doing it for personal motives, if your whole religion is based on what can I get from it, what honor can I get from it, where is the due that's going to come to me from it? So that's where you're wrong. That's why it's a machloke, which is not l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven, and that's why it will not endure. The whole focus of our avodas Hashem, our service of God, has to be for altruistic purposes, because this is the way we know that we need to serve God, not how we can benefit along the way. So in summation, the three arguments of Korach and the connection to Kayin. Element number one is we're all holy, the high priest as well as the day laborer. yes, Korach was right, everyone is holy. But the day laborer is only holy in potential because the whole point of life is to connect with the ever-present, all-encompassing being of God which fills this world, and we can only do so when we elevate the material to the spiritual. And that's what Cain was missing. It's not just bringing any of the crops, it's bringing the best. Taking the best of our time, the best of our abilities, and investing that into the spiritual. And in that way, you're creating a world of holiness. Level number two, what Korach was arguing against was the concept that we need anyone holy. Anyone raised above everyone else. Everyone is holy. We don't need a mashpia and a mekabel. We don't need that pipe that's going to constantly feed that hole a fresh source of water. And that's what the problem with Cain was with as well. He didn't want to be a mekabel. He didn't want to be a receiver from heaven. We need to realize that at times in life, we need to accept. We need to get guidance. We can't rely on the education that we have. It's a pit that is not being replenished with ever fresh water that's new with tremendous vitality. And third level, Korach's argument was, we can all be holy. We can all ascend and try to aspire to great levels of holiness. The answer is absolutely. We can and we should aspire to these levels. But ask yourselves the question, are we doing it in order that we can gain benefit from it, or are we doing it because this is the service of God? And that's the frustration of Cain. Was he frustrated because God didn't accept his korban, or was he jealous that God accepted someone else's korban? We need to ask ourselves and to be cognizant of it in our service of God. Not only to look at our aveiros and our sins and see where we've messed up, but look at our mitzvos as well. The Balei Mussar say that our mitzvos too need to be checked. Are we doing mitzvos in order that we connect to God, l'shem shamayim? Are we doing mitzvos to connect to ourselves, l'shem atzmo? And this is what we need to check out in life, and this is where the problem of Korach was, where there was too much of self and ego involved, and not as much as real altruistic of service of God.